And we are back. Mike, and Oscar coming in. Starting off your week right. Lovely Monday morning.
I'm heating up, man.
Yeah?
I feel my face reddening. Hot takes coming.
Feel it in your plums. Instead of giving you another retrospective or movie review, tiptoeing around award season, it's on the horizon. We could all feel it. We could smell it. So we figured nice time to give you another Hollywood hot take episode. That's what we're going to do today. Like much of the same as we did the first time, we're going to go around Hollywood and touch on some stories of the day, some big
yeah,
stories.
Yeah, hot topics, and then we'll get into kind of a summary of the early award season. You know, that first week of December, a bunch of nominations come out, and we'll give you the rundown.
Shot that hot topic a lot when I was in high school. I rebelled against my parents.
I like that South Park episode.
Yeah, big surprise. But that's what we're doing today, so we're going to give you Hollywood hot takes.
Can we do a podcast on South Park episodes?
Number two. We have, I think, eight. We're going to give you four topics each that are kind of on the tips of our tongues that we want to get off our chests, give you our takes on them, and then we're going to...
A lot of body parts.
That's right. And then we're going to go into the awards that have happened, the award shows that have happened. We had the one in New York, one in L.A. AFI came out with their annual list of top 10.
The Critics' Choice.
Critics' Choice nominees have just been announced. So we're going to go all around the Hollywood sphere for you and get into all the important matters, prep you for this Oscar sprint coming up. With the Golden Globes announcements. They might be out. If you're listening to this on Monday, it might be out today.
They're probably out, yeah, by the time you're listening, and we'll have a little something for you soon.
Yeah, we're working on a lot of stuff. We'll tease it at the end for you, but just to start you off on the right foot, you want to get in contact. I can speak. You want to get in contact with us. We'd love to hear from you. As always, we are Mike, and Oscar on Facebook, Mike, and Oscar on Instagram, MMO_pod on Twitter. And we're MikeAndOscar@gmail.com.
Talk to us.
Yeah, if you were a friend of yours, you're big movie fans, if you guys haven't started listening to us, this is the perfect time because we're going to start ramping up and giving you a lot of stuff to deal, get you ready for Oscar season so you can go into the magical night in Tinseltown fully prepared and at the top of your game to impress all your friends and really have an unnecessary and sickening emotional attachment to a movie that doesn't win.
I mean, here's the thing about pushing our podcast. Like, we were dancing on this line just in life, never mind in podcasting. But, like, I don't know if you should tell your best friends about our podcast or your worst friends about our podcast. Should you tell the people you're reluctantly friends with and they'll love us or not? You may have to gauge as much.
Yeah, you could be Quentin Tarantino and Little Nicky, just let the blind preacher standing on the street corner shouting about us.
But if you got a buddy who's just annoying the crap out of you about all of his movie tastes, maybe send him over here. We'll talk to him.
Yeah, we'll take anyone. But speaking of Quentin Tarantino, because I'm the king of the segues, apparently.
Wow, look at that.
All right, seamless transition. First topic we're going to hit on, and it's going to be a question that I give Mike. Quentin Tarantino, working on this Charles Manson movie, this movie about 1969, and all of a sudden, quick pivot, going to make a quick stop into J.J. Abrams' old world. Quentin Tarantino has an idea for a new Star Trek movie, and he's going to at least produce it, it sounds like, if not getting more involved with it. What are your thoughts on the Quentin Tarantino Star Trek universe?
I consume a lot of Tarantino news, and I have over the years. This is not the first time Star Trek has popped into his mouth. He's a big fan.
That's gross.
And he's mentioned... anyway, he has mentioned Star Trek before. He is now... A power player after the Sony deal. I mean, he's always been, but he's front and center and with a lot of studio courtship, right? So maybe that has kind of empowered him to just go right up to J.J. Abrams, say, hey, I got a great idea for a Star Trek movie. I've never really been able to develop it myself to the next step, never had time, never whatever. He has done things off of his, you know, he's at movie number 9, going to be movie number 9 soon, of his 10-movie career that he wants to have. He has done things off that 10-movie track before. He has been the presenter of the Hostel movies, the executive producer of those. He has been a presenter or a producer of The Hero and The Protector, martial arts movies he was involved with while he was making Kill Bill. He was... During his kind of grindhouse phase where he was making that double feature with Robert Rodriguez, Death Proof, he was producing Hell Ride. So Tarantino has, you know, had some divulgence from his normal career path.
Still violent movies, and you know, certainly the hostiles of the world are akin to a lot of gore and stuff. And Star Trek isn't known for the blood and massacre. And
so he did take CSI a couple years back and do two episodes of that. I know that's
another dark matter, yeah.
Dark subject matter. However, for TV, you got to, you know, bleach it to some respect. This totally freaking fascinates me, especially when we think about other stories. And I couldn't get more giddy. Like, I don't know what the superlative of giddy, the giddiest.
High expectations.
I couldn't be more giddy about this because I want to see.
Did you say you're J.J. Giddies? Chinatown? That's a terrible joke.
That's the worst joke ever. I think we have to pause this podcast and just
start
give
crying,
you the shame bell,
sobbing in the
walk
corner.
You around the house here. Oh, my goodness.
Listen to our 1974 Best Actor pod.
You were waiting for that pitch. Good job. Wrong. Not. Sacha Baron Cohen. Not.
Terrible human being.
Okay. Anyway. Oh, wow. Yeah. I have to put Purell on my hands after this one. I totally lost track. But seriously, can you wait for Spock to drop that first F-bomb? Who will play Spock? I mean, there's so many curious things here. Now, let me also say this. I am a Star Trek fan in the sense of the movies. I've never seen any version of the TV show. I have seen as a kid the Shatner Nimoy movies.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen some of the Patrick Stewart movies. I've enjoyed to one degree or another the Chris Pine series. However, I think they've been a bit a law of diminishing returns. I think they've gotten a little worse with the Fast and Furious director doing the last one.
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the points I was going to bring up is that it seems that J.J. Abrams is kind of distancing himself more from each passing Star Trek movie, and he integrates himself more into the Star Wars universe.
His trial run for, you know, franchise reboot, doing the Star Trek reboot first and making that both classically retro and something new and exciting. Bottom line, telling a good story with that first Star Trek movie. I was most impressed with that plot line, I think, more than anything, even though I enjoyed the member berries, another South Park reference, with you know, the Leonard Nimoy involved.
There, man. There's a whole bunch of TV.
Well, we reference South Park for some reason.
You reference. No, but I'm with you. It's also interesting just from an ego standpoint. I mean, will this draw J.J. Abrams back from his Star Wars commitments a little bit? You know, would he work with Tarantino in some capacity as a producer, co-producer on this movie? There's a lot of ground. You're touching on a lot of interesting stuff. You say giddy. Intrigued is the word I would go with. It's very... I mean, this could go very, very right, as most things with Tarantino do. Or, man, this could go blood in the Star Trek universe. I don't know how they're gonna marriage one another. But.
So let me finish with these three, you know, points of speculation. Point number one is that it's gonna be rated R.
Oh yeah, and that seems to be already decided.
They have the Revenant writer amongst others working on the script.
Gonna have a bear fighting Charles Manson in space, it sounds like.
So this first point is, will Tarantino, what role will he have at the end of this? Are they just using his name as possible director to kind of jumpstart the process, fast track the idea, the pre-production? Or is he actually going to direct something he hasn't written? Or will he rewrite it and then direct it? So that's my first question of speculation.
As far as the directing goes, I would be very surprised, especially everyone knows it is so excited and he just landed this big deal with Sony. You can't think that Sony would give him all this money and all this power for the film number 9 and then sit on their hands while he goes to a different property.
Right.
I would think that he's not going to be involved with the directing. That's just a total, I mean, you want a hot take, that's just a total guess on my part.
So that brings me to number 2. Is Tarantino starting to transition past his director's career into more of a producer's role as he gets older, as he ages? That could be fun. Like, maybe he doesn't write and direct movies after number 10, which he said on multiple occasions. He wants to stop at 10 movies. But does he make his abolitionist movie after he stops number 10 after he films number 10. Does he make all these movies he's teased over the year? Does he make his Star Trek movie as a producer after number 10 or at, you know, right before number 10? Does he transition into another career as a producer for his last, you know, 20, 30 years on the planet? That's possible.
I mean, certainly you know, possible.
Coaches transition to GMs, players transition to coaching. We have a lot of directors that become studio executives. Rob Reiner, one of the guys that have had one of the better careers in that regard.
And he does have a couple, you touched on a couple titles, but 21 producing credits to his name, according to IMDb. Hellride, like you said, Planet Terror, Hostel Part 2, Death Proof, Grindhouse. So again, it's all the original Hostel, but the From Dusk Till Dawn's. He's got the experience. I mean, he's no stranger to producing films that he doesn't necessarily have a hands-on approach with as far as the directing goes, so maybe.
And the last thing I'll leave you with, point number three, is which cast does he use? Is this a Tarantino-casted Starship Enterprise? Is Samuel Jackson involved?
Mace Windu on the Star Trek?
Yeah. Is Christoph Waltz in there? Is Bruce Willis Captain Kirk? Is what is happening with this cast? Or does he use the Chris Pine group, which is a good group? I mean, Simon Pegg.
It's the worst
Pegg.
News in the world for Chris Pine right now. He's just... needs that paycheck to come in. All interesting points, and certainly some that we're going to have fleshed out as time goes on. The only tidbit I'll say is that if Samuel L. Jackson can find himself on both the Enterprise and the world of Star Wars, yeah. I don't know. What else is there
and
for
in
him
the
to
Avengers?
Do? Yeah, what does he need to do? The guy's got to, he's literally just, he should have himself dipped in gold, like Goldmember from Austin Powers, and that'll be his legacy. He can be an actual statue.
He has all the legacies.
He's just, man went from Black Snake Moan to, to every space-themed epic. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's certainly an interesting time, and it's almost as if, it's been presented as if Tarantino just kind of thought about a Star Trek movie one day, and he just pivoted to. He's like, yeah, I'll get to Charles Manson in a second, but let me talk to you for a second about this Star Trek.
He's almost like he couldn't help himself.
Yeah, yeah, it's like a kid in a ball pit, you know, going here, going there.
He's empowered by all the wheeling and dealing with Sony. Maybe that. I'm curious to know more about this story if more stuff comes out. And then, yeah, those three prongs of speculation, I'm giddy, the giddiest. So, Mike, All the Money in the World, it's coming out the end of December. Just got its release date pushed back just a little bit.
Surprising. It didn't get pushed back more considering what's going on.
Here's the thing. Of Christopher Plummer's entire career, and I'm going off script here.
All right, good.
Mike gave me a word for word good. What he wanted me to do.
Prepare me for something I'm not ready prepared for. Here we go.
Is this the first time Christopher Plummer has ever been front and center of a marketing campaign? So in a very Seinfeldian way, I have to say, what's the deal with this All the Money in the World marketing?
Yes.
The answer is yes.
Yeah, I can't. I'm trying to rack my brain. I can't think of anything he's been like the face of.
The beginners, I guess, you know, a couple years back, maybe an Oscar campaign, but no.
Now you're going to make me IMDb, you son of a bitch.
I would give you your regular setup, but I was just, I mean, because the marketing is so bizarre. Christopher Plummer is a great actor. He's been in a ton of stuff, but it's almost like everybody's saying, and here's All the Money in the World, starring not Kevin Spacey.
Yeah, I mean, it's akin to, the marketing on this is akin to when, again, you know, big surprise here, I'm a pro wrestling fan, so I'm going to compare it to that, but it's akin to what the WWE has done with Chris Benoit, you know, after his tragedy. They just kind of wiped the slate clean. He never existed. He's not here, even though obviously he did these horrible things and everyone knows it. It's at the forefront of their mind when his name comes up.
But do they go into matches saying, this is not Chris Benoit's match?
No.
By the way, not Chris Benoit starring in this role.
Right. Well, Benoit was in one of the biggest matches ever, was the main event of WrestleMania 20. It was a triple threat with him, Shawn Michaels, and Triple H. Anytime that match is referenced on WWE TV, it's Triple H faced Shawn Michaels in the main event of WrestleMania 20. You know, like, there's glaring emptiness as to where this guy was.
But we know some marketing people, and would they ever pitch a movie based on Christopher Plummer, as good as he is? And if you saw a movie that was a Ridley Scott, Mark Wahlberg, Michelle Williams production, where Christopher Plummer is front and center, we're gonna
yeah. Does Christopher Plummer? Yeah, does Christopher Plummer put asses in the seats?
Never before. Right. I mean, not to say he's a great actor. He is a great actor.
Well, here's and you fell right into my trap because you kind of did set me up for what I wanted to talk about originally. You piece of shit. All the Money in the World. Obviously, we talked about it. This is how we set it up. Kevin Spacey was picked. He beat out Christopher Plummer in the casting. Plummer has said, has gone on the record, I think it was with the Hollywood Reporter, saying that he was in contention for this role originally. And Ridley Scott, after the Kevin Spacey story broke out, all the awfulness that he did in his past, Ridley Scott went to Christopher Plummer personally and asked him to come on, and Christopher Plummer said yes. That's why the film got pushed back. They're doing all these reshoots now, and they're adding millions upon millions to this budget in doing so, is right. What I went. I mean, the original budget was estimated to be around $40 million. Not a small amount, so let's say this is the budget ends up around 50.
And right. When the first trailer came out, everybody was like kind of gaga over it. I mean, they were into it. They're like, this trailer looks fantastic. You know, Ridley Scott, Mark Wahlberg, Michelle Williams, and at the time, Kevin Spacey playing this big figure. You know, Kevin Spacey's been a great actor in a ton of stuff. I mean, he's turned out to be a scumbag, but he's been a great actor in a ton of stuff. And at the time, everybody was like, okay.
Yeah. And
let's do it.
And replacing Spacey at this late, I mean, they missed the window to be considered for the Critics' Choice Award because their screener wasn't ready because they were in the middle of these reshoots.
So, Mike, what do you think about All the Money in the World missing the Critics' Choice nomination consideration window?
Your instinct is that this movie
See,
is
going to... See, I did it.
Yeah, I'm very proud of you. Your instinct is that this movie is going to be a flop, I think, right? I mean, like, you can't reshoot a whole movie in a matter of a couple of weeks, a $50 million budget movie, and pull it off. At least that was my thought going into it. But then I did a little research. Let me throw some films by you. These are all people, all films that ended up having replacements to major roles after shooting had begun, after the pre-production process. And a surprising theme was threaded out throughout them.
Interesting.
$50 million budget movie is this one. Apocalypse Now. Scorsese pulled Harvey Keitel from the lead role, gave it instead to Martin Sheen, which we know about after a couple weeks of shooting. It was a $31 million budget movie. It ended up domestically taking in over $80 million.
Yes.
8 Oscar nominations, 2 wins.
Good choice.
Aliens did the same thing. It wasn't Ridley Scott property. This was James Cameron this time.
Right.
Who did replace Michael Biehn, replaced James Remar. Again, $18.5 million budget. Domestically took in $85 million. V for Vendetta. Another big movie. Uh-huh. Hugo Weaving replaced James Purefoy as the titular role of V. A $54 million budget, grossed $70 million domestically. It was even a relative flop like Demolition Man. Called in Sandra Bullock to play the role of Tank Girl and replacing Lori Petty after shooting had begun. Ended up grossing back its $57 million budget. It was a relative flop. You know, it didn't really make a lot of money,
wow,
but it made its money
way back.
Right. So there's a theme to all these. Not to mention two of the biggest of all time. The most well-known is Michael J. Fox replacing Eric Stoltz in Back to the Future. Yes. Huge franchise, yes. Made a bajillion dollars. Also, Viggo Mortensen replaced Stuart Townsend after 2 days of shooting as Aragorn in the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Oh, wow.
Right? So,
yes.
What do all these movies have in common? Well, either they make a shitload of money, like the Lord of the Rings, like the Back to the Futures.
Those are success stories right there, my friend.
Yeah. Either they make their money back, at least.
Yeah.
Or when they don't make their money back, such as in The Lovely Bones, where Ryan Gosling showed up apparently 60 pounds overweight to set and ended up being replaced by Peter Jackson by Mark Wahlberg because he wanted someone more in shape for the part. That movie got an Oscar nomination with Stanley Tucci for Best Supporting Actor. So
he's just having fun in his early 30s, I mean, as far as I'm concerned.
There's a precedent here for these late shifts in changing of these big roles of these big budget movies that lead to success, whether financially or critically. Again, my instinct was that this would hurt the movie, but Christopher Plummer, like we just said, is a fantastic actor. The hype train kind of already left the station with this movie. Everyone was talking about it. Maybe it doesn't hurt it as much as we all think it will. And
so
maybe it makes money.
These audibles that these Hollywood suits call, they can work.
They seem to be working out. Now, that said, right now, looking at Gold Derby, All the Money in the World only has in all the major categories, so picture, lead actor, lead actress, supportings, screenplay, All the Money in the World only has one critic who picked one person for one award out of all, you know. And it was a USA Today critic picked Christopher Plummer, had him number 4 as his best supporting actor. So who knows? Maybe it's not going to be the critical darling. Again, I thought it would suffer, but history says this is a good move.
Interesting. I don't think the movie will have as much of a campaign as it wanted to. I don't think I'm going out of a limb on that in that regard. It's impossible for them to have the same kind of Oscar campaign. They've had bad press. And here's the thing. The principle that there's no such thing as bad press is not true in the least.
Well, not anymore with social media.
for life or definitely Hollywood.
Yeah.
So they've had a lot of bad press. And that has been kryptonite for movies. That has been, you know, leprosy, according to the Academy. Like, Meyerowitz Stories is not going to show up on anything that we talk about today. All the Money in the World is really not going to show up. Baby Driver, if it had a chance in hell as a darling, not going to show up.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point.
These people who get outed as, you know, for monsters, sexual harassment, yeah. They drag the film down like an anchor into the deep sea.
It's a good point, and there's precedence in as far as having to replace an actor dealing with either fit by according to the director or dealing with them doing something on set, which drove people away. There's no precedent for this kind of big movement towards equality, basically, and cleaning up the scum that's going on in Hollywood right now. So,
speaking of which,
yeah. So in cleaning up the streets of Hollywood and all the scum that's kind of swirling around the drain, Bryan Singer is a thing. Mike, Bryan Singer got fired from Bohemian Rhapsody, which is the Queen / Freddie Mercury biopic. Reports to have some issues with Rami Malek. Reports to have some issues with, being a decent human.
This story has layers of rape.
Oh, God.
listen. None of us know. The man is being sued recently.
Allegedly.
A new lawsuit has been filed against him. This story broke last night about the 17-year-old statutory rape, I want to say it is. I don't remember.
AOL had it. Variety had it. Big publications.
It is a gross story. The allegations are 14 years old. The victim was at the time 17 years old again. Now, Bryan Singer is... And he was listed and he was signed to direct the Queen Freddie Mercury story that was working titled Bohemian Rhapsody, starring Rami Malek, who's Mr. Robot. He was signed before this wave of, major stories, major news explosions of sexual harassment, sexual assault, the big ousting, the blacklist that has formed of late. With Hollywood elites being taken down from their pedestals, at the very least, you could say it's accomplished many more things. We've talked about it in previous episodes. It's a better thing for our world. It's a better thing in the long run for the industry. It is an all-around good that this is happening. So my question, and I'm going to go right into speculation on this one, is the studio with this whole story just trying to distance itself from Bryan Singer at the end of the day? They have a big property. They have a property that they think still has some upside. Are they trying to just get out of the Bryan Singer business? This is Fox now. Fox has been in the Bryan Singer business for a long time. We're going to talk about what he's done with the X-Men franchise. Are they trying to back away?
It's the way the story was framed, at least what I saw, maybe you saw something different, was that it was mainly due to conflicts between him and Rami Malek. Now, this rape accusation of the 17-year-old came out last night, which was a couple days removed from when Singer first got the boot from the set. There was a story about Singer attending to an ill parent of his.
And yes. He had multiple explanations where one
and
was
anytime
that...
anytime there's multiple explanations, you think something's
It sounded fishy from how he was quoted. At least the presentation of it sounded fishy. And I don't know if it's fishy. I don't know. He could have a close relative who is gravely ill. He could be, sick himself. He could have fallen very sick himself. I mean, we've all seen that happen. We've all been in those situations where, of course, when shit is going down in your life or when shit is going wrong, that's the perfect time when you get the flu or when you get sick, you yourself get sick. It's possible. When I first read this story, it felt to me like, okay, this accused rapist of 14 years ago did something else. Nutty. Got fired.
Right, and that's how it feels.
It was an awkward story. Yeah. Now, when you recontextualize it, when you really think about it, there's a lot that could be going on behind the scenes.
I mean, these studios can't be standing for this stuff anymore, right? They know they're in. This is a big shift change in Hollywood that they got to be terrified about being linking these huge properties. And it's not like Singer wasn't a controversial director to begin with. You know, he's had his issues aside from all these horrible allegations. He's had his issues interpersonally on set with other actors and.
And you don't have to do much to read executives. Between the lines here, because there's some kind of documentary coming out about him. Ill-favored documentary. There's obviously this lawsuit that if the story came out last night, must have been brewing. You know, the people in the know must have had an idea this was coming.
We're Hollywood's getting to the point where Jack McBrayer is going to be the only guy any studio trusts, like this squeaky clean. I have a really lame joke if you want to hear it about Bryan Singer.
So do I, but go ahead, you first.
You could say that he's paying his dues time after time, and he's doing his sentence and has committed a crime.
Oh my God, that's terrible. So I just wanted to...
He is not the champion.
Quip as everybody crashes their cars. I just had a quick, like, we're going to follow up on this Rosemary's Baby for you folks down the line, because this is gross. Yeah, no, it's just a little quick.
That's good. Okay, right. Good. It was better than mine, that's for sure.
Mike, this is your favorite franchise in movie history.
I really don't want them to screw it up.
David Gordon Green is helming a new Halloween movie. It is entitled Halloween. You have the director of Pineapple Express, Eastbound and Down, Red Oaks, early in his career. He kind of moves into dramas. He recently did Stronger after Prince Avalanche and Our Brand is Crisis. I have a couple questions for you, but what do you think about the casting of Andy Matichak? She is going to play the granddaughter of Jamie Lee Curtis. This is via an article in Bloody Disgusting. She is a Blue Bloods actress. And then two-part question.
Take the first part last.
Good, good debating technique. You're a massive debater. Is this a Get Out effect where you have a comedy director being assigned to, you know, like a Jordan Peele style, a horror movie? I'm not saying we're going to get a satire at the end of the day here, but is this a Get Out effect, Jordan Peele effect?
So,
with David Gordon Green. So what do you think about the people involved in your favorite franchise?
Let's do the, and this is near and dear to my heart. I went as, there was like five or six Halloweens in a row where I went as Michael Myers out to various parties.
Right.
I own the Blu-ray collection that costs like $300 with 15 discs. My dog ate one of the discs on me, and
that
I almost
shrine is
her.
Really creepy to my left here. Yeah. The candles just won't go out.
Yeah. I had a sister once and I murdered her. No, listen, I love this franchise. As far as, is this Jordan Peele? I sure hope so. I mean, we're not going to compare Halloween to Get Out in terms of the racial discussions and all that.
But he's a talented cuck. He's a talented comedy director.
Yes, he is.
Back in the
day.
So
I hope, and he's been attached, like you said, to serious properties like Stronger, not horror movies, obviously.
Right. They went for it with Our Brand is Crisis, the Sandra Bullock politics movie 2 years ago.
Success.
Didn't work. Prince Avalanche was kind of an effective dramedy, but
and Danny McBride also is tied to this. It's David Gordon Green's mm-hmm. going to direct. Danny McBride's one of the producers. McBride has come out in BloodyDisgusting.com. If you're not familiar with it, it's a big horror based website. Deals with horror video games, movies. It's a great place to go for a lot of information on that stuff.
Shout out there.
He's had McBride anyway has been either interviewed or picked up an interview at Bloody Disgusting, and he said he's a lifelong fan of the property. He knows how revered and respected all the fans are of Michael Myers. He knows how important this property is to them, and he wants to do right by the fans. Keeps talking about the fans.
Right.
That gives me hope. You know, I mean, hopefully we're not going to have, like, the movie Fall by the Wayside where Busta Rhymes, spoiler alert, survives Michael Myers like a Halloween Resurrection, which I'm still not over.
But you have Blumhouse involved, correct? You have
yes.
Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yes.
John Carpenter.
Judy Greer is going to play Jamie Lee Curtis's daughter. There's some big names. There's some big talented names. So as far as Andy Matichak goes, I'm not familiar with her work. I don't watch Blue Blood. She wasn't in a whole lot of stuff. Her filmography's not that big. She looks the part, certainly. She looks like a Strode. I'm hopeful. That's all I can say. I mean, as giddy as you are for Tarantino's Star Trek, I'm trepidatiously anxious.
Sure.
About the Halloween. I'm hopeful. I'm really hopeful. I think it's an easy money-making property. If they get it right, they could churn out more sequels. And who doesn't love seeing Michael Myers and the cathartic of just, you know, murdering the shit out of everyone? They tried reviving
it with Rob. Branchester by me.
Yeah. They tried reviving it with Rob Zombie. It had mixed effects, mixed success.
That was gross. I mean, yeah, it looked good. It's
too hard on the, and they moved Dr. Loomis out.
It was just like him stomping around and killing and killing and killing. I have my slowly issues
with that. But yeah, I'm hopeful. I love this movie. I love this franchise. I want Michael Myers to be a thing in the cinematic world.
Whereas, you know, the original John Carpenter movies is every trick in the horror movie director's.
It's like the perfect horror movie.
You know, toolkit there. Yeah.
It's like the, and there's no blood in the original Halloween. It's like, it's so good. Obviously, if you haven't seen it, you have to see it. But there's no jump scares. Not a lot of jump scares. There's just a great story. And that's right. What I think, I hope that this movie has is a great story at the center of it. We'll see.
Fingers crossed.
Time will tell. Yeah, I mean, time will tell with all of these.
You can take that Michael Myers mask off now, please.
No, thank you. We'll go now. Over the weekend, we had a...
Drinking your iced cinnamon almond milk macchiato through the Michael Myers mask. I'm a little
small
freaked out.
Mouthhole, yeah. Over the weekend, we had the 20th anniversary screening of Wag the Dog, one of your favorite movies, incidentally, hosted by Tribeca in New York. John Oliver hosted that panel, and Dustin Hoffman was there, and John Oliver thought this was the perfect time to kind of press Dustin Hoffman about his sexual harassment and sexual assault allegations that came out of the 70s that have been following him around in the news. What do we have on this topic?
So, gambit of emotions as you watch this video, which is posted in a CNN article, all right? So you can actually watch John Oliver questioning Dustin Hoffman at this event in New York City, and it goes on for 6 minutes, and you can see for yourself. It is a kind of a creep fest in a way. It's awkward, very much so. It is also a roller coaster of emotions because... And this is coming from a white man who's never been abused in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
This is coming from somebody like me who's kind of sad on the one hand that Dustin Hoffman did this, who's glad, like we've talked about these, you know, people being outed.
Streets being cleaned up, yep.
And it was just completely, it blew my mind how Dustin Hoffman, he started off on the wrong foot immediately. You know, John Oliver asked him about, in a fairly leading way, but it wasn't like an ambush. He asks him in a long question about these allegations. And Dustin Hoffman starts with his lawyer's strategy that they told him to say. You know, he was told to say that if, and he makes a big emphasis on the word if he did these things, he is sorry for hurting these people.
It's amazing. Like, how many times in history are we going to deal with these famous people that are under pressure? The best thing you could do is just own it. You know? I mean, if you did something wrong, I know it's a serious topic, like sexual, but just own it. Just say, you know, yeah, I fucked up, or I was a different person. It doesn't excuse it, blah, blah, blah. I mean, look at the steroid scandal in baseball. Andy Pettit and A-Rod are basically scot-free because they owned it, and everyone else, Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds, aren't. You know, it's right. Just, you become a villain if you don't own it.
What was interesting about this is that Oliver completely smells blood here and totally goes at Hoffman throughout this interview, even though he maintains his cool. And, other than saying he was pissed off by something Hoffman said once, he does, you know, keep his composure up there. John Oliver really gets Dustin Hoffman to say more, and that's the job of a good interviewer. I'm not saying that John Oliver, this comedian turned satirical, you know, politics / news parody show host on HBO Last Week Tonight, you know, he should be the moral.
Phenomenal show.
Yeah, I love the show too. I mean, should he be the moral arbiter of everything or this?
Yes, he's British. Of course he should.
Obviously not. Like, he would agree.
What?
I'm sure he would agree with that as well. Like, he should not. But this was an opportunity that he could capitalize on and get Dustin Hoffman's opinions out there, which is, you know, there's a journalistic responsibility there. So Dustin Hoffman essentially recontextualizes it, makes excuses based on the time period they were in, makes excuses based on the long days of shooting they were having, the overfamiliarity. You know, he didn't go down the drug corridor with this one. He didn't mention that he was possibly on drugs. But listen, I've been on movie sets before. I've worked on movies before. You're there all day, weeks in a row, you know, even just a weekend shoot when I was young as a PA. You become super familiar with the people you're working with because it's a collaborative exercise. It's not something where everybody goes off in their cubicle, does their job. You get on the phone for X amount of time every day. It's not the job as, you know, someone below the line on a film set. You are working with people all day, every day. Obviously, as an actor and an actress, you know, you're waiting for hours on end sometimes to do the scene. Whether you're getting makeup or whether you're just waiting for them to set up the cameras, set up whatever they got to set up. There's a million things, a laundry list. So it makes sense to me that they become close, especially during a months-long shoot, a year-long shoot. It makes sense that they become like a quote-unquote surrogate family. However, all that makes sense. Dustin Hoffman just pulls the cat out of the bag, though, this ugly, horrible, insanely Halloween gross cat pulls the cat out of the bag that he just, we were saying messed up things to each other around the room, seeing who could say the most weird thing, messed up thing, ridiculous thing, as people can do. We've all been in dorm rooms, yeah. Whatever, you know, you could say even at family dinner tables, this happens. And I get that. And, you know, as long as it doesn't, you know, start to target people necessarily, it makes sense. But you have this 17-year-old intern who was growing familiar with the people in the room, and he grabs her ass. And then she screams at him, and he mentioned that one thing. Obviously, he didn't know. He said he didn't know she was 17. Whatever. But
because that matters.
Yeah, it shouldn't matter there. I just don't know how you go from, all right, talking shit to sexually assaulting somebody. Like, I just, it doesn't register on how you can get there.
I don't think that, yeah. I mean, I understand your point, but I don't, the how.
That's the part that blows my mind. Yeah. Like, it doesn't, I get it. We've seen it in movies a thousand times over, about the 60s, the 70s. We've seen the gangsters grabbing and copping feels all over the place.
Look, there's certainly a line that, like, it was a different time. It was a different time. Like, there was stuff that was okay. There was stuff that was okay 3 years ago that's not okay anymore, right. You know? The 60s and 70s, certainly. It was with all the free love that was going on, and obviously we're not old enough to speak about a personal experience from there. Should you be persecuted for stuff that happened 40 years ago? Well, yeah. I mean, you still did it, right? It's still wrong to have done. You can't touch another person against their will. That's a law. That's assault, brother, as the line goes. Like, you can't do that. You're getting into a quagmire here with dealing with all these personalities, and like you said, it makes you sad. To me, it's more cut and dry. If you did it, fuck you.
Right.
You know, I mean...
You know, here's the thing. Like, is there ever an explanation?
It's not easy to talk about.
You know, if everybody is... If they're just having an ass-grabbing party at, you know, 4 a.m. at the Roxy Club out there, and it's going to... You know, it's almost turning into an orgy.
If your friends were jumping off a bridge, would you jump?
That's one... Where everybody's high or drunk or both and everything. You know, that's one thing where you say, okay, this is kind of one of those crazy party scenarios where everybody's doing messed up things. Everybody's wrong. I mean, I'm not rationalizing it to say it was right, but I'm saying at least that makes more sense to go from, okay, we're doing like an around the room talking shit session,
and then,
whatever we're doing, right. We do one of these exercises to quote unquote break the tension, and then and John Oliver basically calls his bullshit as best he can several times over. He, in a way, he kind of dances on the level of he doesn't want to get the crowd going at Dustin Hoffman because they're clapping for him. It happens at the end, but he really plays it well, I thought. It was interesting. But you could see, and this is what a lot of guys in our position are doing now, it's awkward for us to be moral authorities on this. It's awkward for us to be, you know, the voices of reason on this. It's really not our place. So that's basically what I'm going to end with is, you know, we're listening to what a lot of women have been saying. I've you know, Pod Save America and the Crooked Media guys have had some really good guests and interesting interviews that have, you know, essentially recontextualized is the wrong word usage because I just use that negatively. Essentially recreated my thinking on this in many ways. So I think the bottom line is we want to listen to the women in our life. We want to listen to the women in public office or the abused men and the victims on this who can be more insightful.
Yeah, we went more into this in the first Hollywood Hot Take, but the overall theme is that it's about the victims. It should be about the victims. If you hear somebody talking about this awfulness happening to them, you gotta believe them. Of course, they're not gonna. I mean, it takes a very sick and twisted person to lie about stuff like that. And usually, if they are lying, they're gonna be found out, like the Washington Post just did with right. that woman trying to, you know. But you have to believe the victims, and it's all about the victims. You got to think about them. You got to be there for them, and you got to support them, which is
so. This is the silver lining at the end of it, which transitions beautifully into our next topic. We did a great job with the programming here. The shakeup at DC. Patty Jenkins just did a wonderful job with Wonder Woman. It is the number one movie on the year thus far. I think it's up there, and it's basically being used as a tentpole for DC's other movies, along with It and Dunkirk. Justice League has not made what it needs to make. It's $573 million and counting gross. Is not up to the probably $750, $800 million it needs to make off a $300 million budget to get into black. Now, we're seeing a refreshing take, you know, a refreshing movement in Hollywood where Patty Jenkins gets to make the female empowerment movie. It's not Rob Reiner. Mm-hmm. It's not me or you. It's Robert Redford. It is, you know, Patty Jenkins, thankfully. All right. We're getting Lady Bird from Greta Gerwig. Mm-hmm. We're getting Black Panther from Ryan Coogler. Now we have a shakeup at DC, and they're wondering why, you know, these movies aren't making as much money. They're wondering why these movies aren't working. Was Justice League, Mike, too big to fail? Did Warner Brothers think it was too big to fail? And what does it say about the industry when a movie that's grossed $573 million is looked upon as a failure and heads roll at the studio for a movie that makes that amount of money?
Yeah, this topic kind of angers me, honestly, because it's more to that last thing you just said. What are we doing here? Like, we have these major motion pictures that the Justice League had a $300 million budget. And like you said, right now, it's with its international raking in, it's at like $570 some odd million as of
right.
2 days ago, on December 7th.
Yes.
It's going to make probably double its budget back, at least. It'll make $600, you think.
On video, it'll probably break even if that's the case. Yes.
Right. So you have money. This giant property that's making the better part close to $1 billion. And that's a failure in this day and age. I mean, are you kidding me? For those of you that don't know the total background, John Berg was the head of DC Film Division. He's been replaced in the company and reassigned to a producer role with Roy Lee. He's going to be kind of a partnership with Roy Lee, who's already contracted to WB. Lee is a producer attached to established titles such as The Ring, The Lego Movie, The Departed. He's a big name in the industry.
Right.
Bigger story here is what's going to happen next with the DC Expanded Universe. We have to find someone to replace John Berg. The creative officer, the chief creative officer of DC, is a man by the name of Jeff Johns, who kind of was a success story in that he worked his way up the company. He was a fan, and he became a comic book writer, and worked. He's the guy at the helm of this. He's a co-chief with an executive out of Warner Brothers, the studio itself.
Okay.
They made the decision, and they're framing the whatever you want to call it on John Berg's part, the firing, the demotion, the whatever. Mm-hmm. They're saying John Berg came to the studio and he always wanted to be a producer for Warner Brothers, so we're going to give him that opportunity, and he's going to be a producer now. He's going to make movies for us. It's like, okay, but he was just your chief creative. You know, he was just the guy in charge of the whole film industry there at DC. So now you have to find a guy. They got to find a guy whose vision aligns with Jeff Johns, who can make apparently a movie that has to make $1 billion, which is not an easy task to do, even in this day and age, to be considered a success. Like, Justice League was hurt by a myriad of things, right?
Right.
Like, Snyder was attached to it, and then Snyder left, so Joss Whedon came in, and Joss Whedon rewrote some of the script and then had to do some reshoots, so you kind of have this Frankenstein of a picture. And then when it did hit the screeners, all the critics kind of shit all over it because of the bad... some of them had the bad taste in their mouth from Batman v Superman already. Not to mention, they tried to... The DC studio tried to introduce all these characters in a span of two movies in 16 months.
They did kind of a reverse of the Marvel studio model.
Marvel, you had five movies over the span of 4 years to introduce six characters, right? I mean, and they were able to fully flesh out most of them, and you were able to understand and have an emotional attachment to most of them. And it was a story, I think the Avengers are more familiar to the audience than Justice League. I don't know, that's just an opinion.
Yep.
Justice League, they saw what Marvel did, and in 2010 they formed the DC movie studio, so they're already a year behind.
Right.
Batman v Superman comes out, it's a total flop, it's a big waste, everyone hates it, and they shoot way too many of their loads out,
and yet it still makes enough money to be looked at as very profitable.
Right, yeah. Right. As, I mean, and this is not going to be very profitable, but it's going to make its unbelievable money back, and you're having this guy fall on the sword for things that were out of his control. I mean, yeah, he was in charge of DC Studios, but he's not in charge of the director leaving the project, hiring a new visionary. The visionary is a guy that's going to reshoot everything. He's not in charge of the bad press that the movie's gotten. I mean, it's to me, it kind of pisses me off. I think John Berg is kind of falling on the sword for something that's not his fault and for the whole studio's mistakes.
So you had an optimum phrase last night when we were talking where it was too many cooks in the kitchen. Is that possible with something like this, or do you want to see more sharp minds involved? There are different vantage points and viewpoints and expertise levels.
You don't see, especially in superhero movies, any time you have a collaboration, I feel like it fails, right? I mean, the Fantastic Four from a couple years ago was supposed to be the director had one vision, the studio had another, and those two aspects competed, and that movie was awful.
Right.
You know, I mean, anytime there's, I think if you're going to try to make a universe, hire one director for the film, go with that director's vision, support him, and let him try to tell a story.
So the Disney's had the magic touch, and we can look no further than Thor Ragnarok, where you have this unique director, Taika Waititi. He essentially is allowed to do what others who have been fired from the Disney universe, like the ones on the Solo movie, all the way back to Edgar Wright, have not been able to do, and that's kind of improvise some comedy. So Disney kind of allowed that style of directing to happen a little more. And now, so you have Disney allowing a director do his own thing, but they make sure that he conforms to their story machine, essentially, that is going to produce this kind of story and accomplish the things it needs to accomplish for the overall.
Oh, you can have an arc. I mean, I cinematic think universe. It's important that the director sticks to the studio's, you know, not vision, but the studio's story arc. But I think once the studio or once another director or supervisor starts micromanaging and the plot and rewrites and stuff like that.
But doesn't this feel like DC, they fired the GM in the middle of the season, you know, for a sports analogy?
I wouldn't even say the GM. I think they fired Tom Coughlin. I think Jerry Reese let Tom Coughlin go, right? Like, to save his own face. That's what it feels like to me. I mean, especially if you're doing it because of circumstances beyond his control, it just feels dirty to me.
And it was already a hot mess, you know, coming out of
Batman.
And
it's making money. Like, it's going to make its money back. It's a giant production, and it's going to be a billion-dollar property at some point.
My hope is that they can go and reference their own success story with Patty Jenkins and Wonder Woman and kind of maybe allow things to take part that way, you know, give one director who has a clear vision, who's going to, you know, follow a genre format that works, that's now tried and true.
And that's what I'm saying, and you're saying it more eloquently than I am.
Well, even if it's a Disney format, why don't you know,
pick a director, believe in their vision, support their vision. I think that's the way to go with these big things. And, you know, it's a hundreds of millions of dollar gamble, but when you do it that way, it seems to pay off. When you do it the other way, where you're mixing in a lot of pieces, too many cooks in the kitchen, like you said.
It seems like they have some opportunities. Like, who wouldn't want to see a Flash movie? Like, that looked fun.
Yeah.
Like, the Cyborg movie looked, you know, his backstory seemed fun.
We have the first look of Aquaman, the photos coming out.
Yeah, it's a little up and down on Aquaman, but they could do Supergirl, Harley Quinn. I mean, they got options.
And God bless Margot Robbie there for putting her money up to get that Harley Quinn movie funded. Look, I want DC to succeed. I think we all do. I think it's a better world if we have a DC franchise, a DC world and a Marvel world, you know? I mean,
it was strange because for the longest time, DC had a hero problem and Marvel had a villain problem. Now, like, Marvel has no problems, but Marvel has been much stronger in the villain area. And
Steppenwolf?
And yeah, the DC villains have just been
Doomsday is kind of a throw into Batman and Superman. Like,
silly,
what are you doing?
Silly.
Yeah.
And the Doomsday stuff was the best part of the movie, I thought.
But it should have been there.
Again, to go back to the DC problem that we talked about in my Justice League review a little bit, you know, unless you have a villain called Super Duperman, Superman is not going to work as a story device. They totally got away from the kryptonite factor on Superman. The whole part of Superman that was interesting to a lot of folks, or that made him quote unquote vulnerable, was kryptonite.
Here's my two cents.
And nothing is, there's no kryptonite in this new Superman universe.
Creatively, if the Marvel movies are all about the heroes, why don't you have the DC be all about the villain? Like, have the Joker be the overall guy, the overall baddie that everyone's working towards in all these movies. Have him have access to kryptonite, and he works with, you know, Harley Quinns and the Doomsday. That's my two cents, but,
right,
you know, why, if you're going one way, why not go the other? See if it works. You gotta do something. I mean, DC, the properties deserve better than they're having. But speaking of Marvel,
yeah,
we have a big shakeup coming down the pipe. It seems that Disney wants to buy parts of Fox. Fox obviously owns properties in Marvel, such as the X-Men. What could Marvel do with the X-Men? Is it bittersweet after Deadpool, Logan, Few Days of Future Past?
It's a bittersweet situation for me because Fox has done a good job with Deadpool. They really have.
Great job.
I enjoyed Logan. It had its flaws. I enjoyed Logan. I enjoyed Days of Future Past by Mr. Singer a couple years back, even though I remember at the time I was like, oh, this is kind of a gross situation, because those allegations were just coming out or came out beforehand and were like...
But you're right, the movie on its... Take the movie in a vacuum, it's good.
Days of Future Past was one of the stronger X-Men movies, in my opinion. Logan's probably my favorite...
I think everyone would agree with you.
X-Men movie, even though it's focused on just Wolverine. Deadpool was a genre shifter. It was a momentous occasion for superhero movies, like, you know, this Quentin Tarantino Star Trek movie, perhaps.
Hopefully.
You went rated R with Deadpool. You went rated R with Logan. You gave fans what they want. Obviously, these properties came out years and years ago. They came out in the 70s, 80s. You know, so the audience is not necessarily just kids anymore. You know, they're guys our age and much older, 30s, 40s, 50s, that will see these
cartoons of them. Yeah,
make a rated R version if you dare and market it the right way and make a good movie and tell a good story. It can work. So now Disney. So on the one hand, I'm a little worried that Disney's going to go away from this formula that Fox has found to work for them. Now,
the
Fox,
Avengers versus X-Men versus Mickey's Clubhouse.
It can become well oversaturated. Now, Disney's done a good job up to this point. They haven't oversaturated their movies.
They,
Captain America Civil War was just a clinic on how to do
it. They are King Midas right now.
Right. They've done a great job. Now, Disney right now has an 18% market share. Fox has a 12% market share, according to Forbes at the time of this article when it was written. So you have, if Disney acquires Fox Marvel, they're acquiring all the most lucrative parts of Fox. Do they acquire all of Fox? That's still a question that I have. I don't know if that's being answered right now. You know, all of Fox's... You know,
Sean Hannity going to have to wear Mickey ears during his reports every night on Fox News?
Yeah, I mean... Do they acquire, never mind Fox News, but the rest of their movie properties.
Right.
So if Disney were to have a 40% market share, Forbes worries about and wonders about, could that mean something for the overall business? Could, if Disney is an evil tyrant with it, could they hike up prices?
You
could
are much more optimistic about this than I am.
Too powerful to control, and could they just then eat up the whole industry after that? Will we have a monopoly at the end of this? That can't be a good thing, can it? So
no.
You have potential Armageddon, as you mentioned last night. You have a potential movie apocalypse behind the scenes.
I believe I called it the end of the film industry.
The end of the film industry. Or, as Forbes mentioned it, you could wind up with Disney versus Netflix and Amazon. You know,
that a good thing?
Will you have the streaming folks and the theatrical release folks going against each other? Will those growing companies emerge and kind of dwarf everybody else or buy everybody else out? And no, I don't think it's a good thing at the end of the day. Now, if Disney just acquires Fox, Marvel's, X-Men, Deadpool, and Logan, you know, or X-Men and Deadpool, right? If they just acquire those and then they figure out Fantastic Four, okay, does that necessarily, it makes Disney stronger, but does that necessarily doom the industry and write the, you know, book of Revelations for film? I don't think so. If they acquire everything Fox has, you know, that's, you know, now we're talking a bigger.
What if they acquire Battlefield shift? Earth?
The Scientologists, I would never underestimate them. I would never.
I don't have a ton to say
about the Disney acquiring Fox Marvel. Another story that we're keeping a close eye on. We're very curious. I'm on the fence if it's a good thing or not. I'm curious to see X-Men after Apocalypse was so bad. X-Men,
how dare you?
I hate it. Apocalypse.
I love Apocalypse. Oh. I know I'm in the minority.
All right, we have to have a podcast.
I know I'm in the minority.
Mike and X-Men. So. I loved Logan. I love Days of Future Past. I'm hit and miss on the other X, or I'm up and down on the other X-Men movies. I would say that this could mean big things for the movie industry, but I'm not going to preach on the street with, you know, a bed full of newspapers and ringing a bell and you know, call for the apocalypse yet. Cardboard box jacket.
Get Bruce Willis in there to drill a hole on an asteroid.
I'm not going to do that yet. So, but here's something that's weird that folks talked about last year with OJ Made in America, Michael. According to an article I recently saw on Slash Film, obviously it's in other places, Sight and Sound's top films of the year polls 180 critics, and they included the list on Slash Film. The 18-episode arc of Showtime's Twin Peaks The Return, David Lynch, Mark Frost, that whole long series, which I have hinted at before, was quite the watch. It's up and down. It had its moments. I enjoyed parts of it. I hated others. It is number two, ranked number two on this, the list of best movies of the year for Sight and Sound. What do you think about that, Mike?
All right. First of all.
This was on The Ringer as well, the Ringer Slash Film. A lot of folks have been covering it.
You ever been in a movie theater for 18 hours? You haven't, right?
No. Not even me.
Because 18-hour movies don't exist. You understand? Television events exist. Miniseries exist. In fact, they have their own category at the Golden Globes. All right? First things first, I can't tell you the number of times a mysterious demon shapeshifted itself out of a magical box and hacked up my friends to bits post-coitus. It's become like sneezing in my life. It's so commonplace. That's neither here nor there. I don't understand how this argument is a thing. Of course, it's a television show. I understand the running thread. I understand the argument against it, but you're all wrong to think this. It's clearly a television show in that it's on television. It's on a premium channel.
Yes, you're not wrong. Now, however, like I would say, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, The Wizard of Wall Street, or what was that, Robert De Niro?
Wizard of Lies.
The Wizard of Lies. These are movies. They're TV movies, essentially. Could you go that far and call something a TV movie?
A movie can be a TV show. A TV show cannot be a movie. Kind of like a square and a rectangle. You understand? Wendy's, the Twitter account of Wendy's, the people that gave us Dave Thomas and Where's the Beef?
Right.
Somebody asked them if Twin Peaks is a movie. Here's was their response. If we call it a movie, then where do we actually draw the line between television and film? The current line seems to be making one episodic, though the current trend in superhero movies could also be called episodic, hard to tell. The first half of that sentence is absolutely correct. You can't call this a movie, because then where's the line between TVs and movies? Why do we have this podcast concentrating on the Academy Awards for movies if it's all one big thing?
It doesn't make sense to me either. I would agree. However, I would say a two-hour Save the Cat, Hero's Journey, you know, format-fitting arc of a story is a... It could be considered a movie.
All we
That's
have
what
to
I
do.
Look at. The Wizard of Lies is a movie. It's just on TV. However, so I would take issue with that one statement. However, I agree with you. 18 hours of episodic television, however episodic it is, even this movie, or this television show, Twin Peaks, there's less of an episodic nature to it because it's more straight through. I would argue that OJ Made in America was extremely episodic last year.
Yes.
I would argue that something like Game of Thrones is less episodic. I would argue that Twin Peaks The Return is less
episodic. Well, that's the thing. If Twin Peaks is a movie, Game of Thrones has to be a movie.
Yeah, you're essentially dropping in to all these different POVs and these storylines that we have throughout. Yes, they do beginning, middle, end for that episode at times. Other times, you get bad episodes of Game of Thrones or bad episodes of Twin Peaks where you're lost in that mire of a middle and... That happened.
I don't know how we came from a good TV show, which needs an ABC storyline, like Breaking Bad is one of the golden age of television, to saying that it's a movie. But all we have to do, Mike, as with everything in life,
right,
is look towards Wikipedia. If you Wikipedia a television show, the first words you're greeted with on the TV show Wikipedia, a television show is a series of related productions intended for broadcast on over-the-air, cable television, or internet television, other than a commercial, trailer, or any other segment of content not serving as an attraction for viewership. More rarely, it may be a single production, also called a television program. Thus, in the same aspect, like I said, in which a square is a rectangle, but a rectangle cannot be a square, a movie can, in fact, be a television show. However, Stephen A. Smith voice, however, a television show, a series of related productions intended for broadcast on over-the-air, cable television or internet television cannot be a movie. The defense rests.
Yeah, I still disagree with Wikipedia.
I said the defense rests.
That's fine. That's fine, Roman Michael T. Israel Esquire. Listen, I don't necessarily think this ought to be a big debate. We both agree on a two-hour story is a two-hour story.
Slow day on the internet. Same. That's all
yeah,
this was.
This was a slow day on the internet. We would agree that O.J. Made in America should have won Emmys last year.
Yes.
Do you want to see Twin Peaks The Return winning any Oscars this year?
No. Absolutely it's not fair.
It's not going to.
It's not fair. You have 18 hours to flesh out different storylines, whereas traditional movies are given 2.5 hours at the most. I mean, how is that fair?
Right. The fat was extremely absurd on this TV show.
So we're going to finish up, as we said, we're touching on award season. We're at the very starting line of the 2017 awards race.
Yeah, we're going to call our coverage of it a sprint.
Yeah.
But it's really a marathon.
Because it's a race, you see. But no, that's what we're going to do. We're going to have a couple episodes leading up to the Oscars that we're going to fill you more in next episode when we cover the Golden Globe nominations. To prepare everyone for the Golden Globe nominations, though, we dealt with two relatively big film awards just happened recently on either coast. We had the New York Film Critics Circle Awards and the LA Film Critics Association Awards. Both happened within the last week or so. As well, AFI released their annual list of the top 10 movies of the year. We're going to give you kind of a quick recap without going into too much detail on those, because again, we're just kind of building towards Oscar season right here. So these are like the previews of the big preview, which is the Golden Globes for Oscars night.
Yeah, this is basically an early award season check-in. We're not going to cover the Indie Spirit Awards. We'll save those until they have their show. Those are for $20 million budgets and less than that, sub $20 million budgets, I think, is still the cutoff for the Gothams and the Indie Spirit. So we're going to, and they kind of go off the rails a little bit with who they pick. If you get a New York or L.A., choosing somebody, typically they're in the running. Typically
it means something.
A nominee for the Oscars. We'll give you some stats as we go through these. And then, yeah, we'll give you some stats about what AFI did. And, of course, Mike, you forgot to mention the Critics' Choice Awards.
Yes, those nominations also just recently came out, so we're going to touch on those.
So we're going to go category by category. You're going to start us off, Mike, best screenplay?
Yes, let's do that. We will go with the best screenplay. The LA Awards, we're just going to say are LA. The New York film ones, we're going to say were New York, for a matter of shorthand, just so you guys can keep up. So for LA, the best screenplay, Jordan Peele for Get Out, which is one we've been beating the drum for, over Martin McDonagh for Three Billboards. New York gave the best screenplay to Paul Thomas Anderson for Phantom Thread. The Critics' Choice nominees in that category for original screenplay are Shape of Water, which got a ton of Critics' Choice award nominations, Lady Bird, Big Sick, The Post, Three Billboards, and Get Out.
So, yeah, I mean, the three big stories there, obviously, Get Out, Three Billboards, and Paul Thomas Anderson for The Phantom Thread. Paul Thomas Anderson is a usual suspect in terms of best screenplays. We talk about, and Mike and Oscar, the best original screenplay. I don't think we're going to read books for this pod.
We don't like learning. No. We try to keep it to original screenplay, especially for purposes of the awards.
So that was the three-headed monster to emerge there. We'll keep an eye on this one. We've said in the past, and we believe it. Just look at the movies that are going to be usual suspects on this entire coverage segment here. Shape of Water, Lady Bird, Big Sick, The Post, Three Billboards, Get Out. That's a loaded Best Original Screenplay category. The Critics' Choice Awards has more nominations in most of its categories than the Oscars will have. The Oscars will have the best five. They'll go up to 10 for Best Picture, but you'll see Critics' Choice going to 6 and 7, 8 nominees.
Shape of Water, 14 Critics' Choice nominations. Huge. That's a big one. And that one, I mean, started slow. It was not right out of the gate, a hot name, but it's picked up momentum. Guillermo del Toro movie. We'll go there to Best Supporting Actress, the category. The L.A. winner was Laurie Metcalf for Lady Bird, who was all over Gold Derby's rankings this category. Mary J. Blige was second there for Mudbound, who was a performance that we both gushed over in our Netflix Year in Review pod. The New York Best Supporting Actress went to Tiffany Haddish for Girls Trip. She's the big story, one of the big stories of the year. Mm-hmm. She's having a big star turn. Critics' Choice Movie Award nominees are Mary J. Blige, Hong Chau for Downsizing, Tiffany Haddish for Girls Trip, Holly Hunter for The Big Sick, Allison Janney for I, Tonya, Laurie Metcalf for Lady Bird, Octavia Spencer for The Shape of Water.
Yeah, the big story is Tiffany Haddish at this point.
She's making her whole career this one year.
I would have never thought that, you know, as covering this category, we'd be preparing to do a Girls Trip pod, all Girls Trip pod. I mean, we're literally doing that. But you have the Florida Project actress Bria Venate, I probably should have looked that up. Lois Smith, Marjorie Prime, Leslie Manville, Phantom Thread, Julia Roberts in Wonder, Melissa Leo in Novitiate, Carey Mulligan also in Mudbound. Those are other names Feinberg Forecast mentions as possibly contenders. But you hit on, in terms of the Critics' Choice, with Hunter, Blige, Chow, Haddish, Janney, Metcalf, and Spencer. Those are the big six.
This seems to be a Metcalf, Mary J. Blige, Holly Hunter.
Right.
For me, anyway, that seems to be the big three of the field here.
You know, we're kind of steering clear of our personal opinions at this point. We'll review these categories thoroughly down the line. But, yeah, I mean, I obviously, Mary J. Blige, we've said some good things about already. We've said some good things about Holly Hunter already. You can go back to a pod for that. I think the world of Laurie Metcalf for Lady Bird, so we're going to have a lot to
Roseanne
say.
Roseanne revival coming out soon. She's involved in that as well. Yes, sir. Important to note, too, like we alluded to in our topics earlier, the hot takes portion, that some of the movies didn't make the cut for the screening of the Critics' Choice, so you're not going to hear All the Money in the World. You're not going to hear any Star Wars. A couple other big movies didn't make the cut, so just an interesting note. But we'll move from supporting actress to supporting actor. L.A. Best Supporting Actor went to Willem Dafoe for The Florida Project, another guy that's all over the Gold Derby lists.
Yes.
Over Sam Rockwell, who was nominated for 3 Billboards. New York Film Award went to Willem Dafoe as well. Critics' Choice, the nominees are Willem Dafoe, who seems to be the leader in the clubhouse, Armie Hammer, Michael Stuhlbarg for Call Me By Your Name.
Stuhlbarg. Yeah,
pronunciation is not our thing. Richard Jenkins for The Shape of Water, Sam Rockwell for 3 Billboards, Patrick Stewart for Logan getting a nod.
That's the big surprise coming out of Critics' Choice. No surprise Willem Dafoe is getting some of these Critics' Awards. I am not so sure about him. He doesn't have a big blowout scene. Typically, when we've covered supporting actor in the past on our retrospectives, they have the big scene.
Our first supporting actor pod, where we did our first episode, where we did the summer movies.
He has these scenes in them, those movies.
Well, we 2012. Not the 2012 version. The first episode, Mike and Oscar, we did when we did our summer movie recap up to that point. Okay. We seem to agree that supporting actor was the weakest of the major categories thus far.
The big names are starting to come out. Yeah, I mean, Willem Dafoe is leading, I would say, but Sam Rockwell has a lot of juice. Michael Stuhlbarg and both Armie Hammer have as good a shot as any. Patrick Stewart is the interesting choice in that one.
Yeah, glad he got a nod. Why not?
Richard Jenkins is on the outside looking in of Feinberg forecasts. Again, he's very accurate. But yeah, no Woody Harrelson for Three Billboards. No Mark Rylance for Dunkirk in the Critics' Choice. There's kind of snubbing.
Both guys that were all over Gold Derby at certain points this year as well. Mm-hmm. And again, the Feinberg forecast and GoldDerby.com are kind of the two that we use for our own purposes. Most of all, as far as, and that's, they're a good amalgamation of all different critics and accuracy as
well. Feinberg's the man.
Best Actress category is what we'll move to next. The LA Best Actress Award went to Sally Hawkins for Shape of Water, beating out Frances McDormand for Three Billboards.
So now I'm going to give you a little bit of background on how these movies stack, or how these award shows stack up to Oscar seasons past. LA, they've missed the last 2 years, but they hit on the 3 years before that, including a snafu where they somehow voted Patricia Arquette in 2014 for Best Supporting Actress winner at the Oscars. They gave her the Best Actress at their LA Film Awards. So that was weird.
What's that? That the amorphous categorization that we talk about all the time. You know, the Al Pacino going as a supporting when he should have been a lead and losing out.
But they're 3 out of the last 5 years they hit an Oscar winner.
We'll see. In New York, the Best Actress went to Saoirse Ronan, who is a love of my life for Lady Bird. God, I love her talent. She's going to be a phenomenal actor. I would like to see her and Jennifer Lawrence share the screen at some point in some movie. In a movie, for Christ's sake. Get your head out of the gutter. I think they're both very extremely talented women.
They've missed, I mean, you're getting excited here, but they've missed New York, that is, 4 of the last 5 years on the Best Actress.
I think they felt bad, like they just were giving her a nod for having the role in Brooklyn, and it's a New York Film Award last year.
They love Saoirse Ronan. Yeah, they gave it to her for Brooklyn a couple years back.
Critics' Choice Award nominations are Jessica Chastain for Molly's Game, which will be hitting wide soon. I believe it's coming out in January, as a matter of fact, for a wide release, which is one of those odd ones. Sally Hawkins for Shape of Water. Frances McDormand for Three Billboards. Margot Robbie for I, Tonya, which is something I know the both of us are very excited to see, very interested to see. Saoirse Ronan for Lady Bird. Meryl Streep for The Post. Got a little bit of a surprise that she hasn't taken home either of the big awards here. She's usually a darling of any kind of critics, gathering of critics.
Yeah, big names. Those are probably the big one, two.
The actress categories this year are going to be loaded.
Those are probably the big six right there.
The lead and the supporting. Both heavy performances, big names. It's going to be a big deal this year. I think we're in for a good award season.
Best actor.
Best actor. Lead actor. The LA Award went to Timothy Chalamet.
Chalamet, yeah.
Chalamet for Call Me By Your Name over James Franco, the Disaster Artist.
Now, don't get too excited for Mr. Chalamet. He's, you know, the LA's missed on the Best Actor the last 6 years.
And I got a feeling the Disaster Artist is going to gain a lot of momentum as we go forward.
I'm surprised they didn't choose the Disaster Artist, movie about movie making. You know, a lot of you know, awardcircuit.com, all those good guys.
Nobody wants to hand the trophy breaker to Tommy Wiseau. Nobody
right, but wants they were saying they thought they had a sneaking suspicion. Disaster Artist, if it was going to break through, it'd break through at the LA, you know, critics.
Mr. Chalamet is going to be disappointed by LA. He's certainly riding a high right now. He also took home the Lead Actor Award for the New York Film Festival.
Well, they hit on last year with Casey Affleck, but they missed 3 out of the last 5 years. You know, we'll see. Again, you know, these movies are very hit. These award shows are very hit and miss in terms of their association with the Oscars.
Again, which is why we're just covering them. The Golden Globes, I think we both agree, are kind of the best.
But it's good that setup. The audience, you know, you but guys yeah, are getting a familiarization with who are the key players.
Know which current movies to catch up on while they're out there. Critics' Choice, this is gonna shock you, but Mr. Chalamet is nominated as well for Best Lead Actor for Call Me By Your Name, along with, he said he's retired, but we'll see how true that is, Daniel Day-Lewis for Phantom Thread, James Franco for The Disaster Artist, Jake Gyllenhaal for Stronger, a very strong performance that we've reviewed here previously, Tom Hanks for The Post, Daniel Kaluuya for Get Out, and Gary Oldman, who was as far as everyone was concerned, Gary months Oldman ago, because of Gary Oldman in Darkest Hour.
Supposed to get it.
But I said it before, I'll say it again, the reviews are not strong for that movie, not yet, not the screeners anyway, so...
So this is fun for us because we've been pitching, you know, Daniel Kaluuya for a while. Denzel is not on here. That was
probably the most notable
takeaway for me. I just saw Roman J. Israel, and he's very good in it. The movie has its major flaws.
Weak movie overall, yeah. Weak movie overall. No Denzel, which is, you know, and I said that to me when you reviewed Roman J. Israel, and I said, I think Denzel might be a little burned, you know, not winning the actor last year, you could definitely see took its toll on him in the moment. I mean,
yeah,
he was
sitting
with tears in his
eyes.
Yeah, I know. It was, I would, you know, different topic for a different day. Best Director category. The LA went to a tie Guillermo del Toro for Shape of Water and Luca Guadagnino, did I say that half right, for Call Me By Your Name.
You know, they've missed L.A. They've missed the Best Director 6 out of the last 7 years, so take it with a grain of salt. Maybe they're trying to double the chances by tying it.
We can't be wrong. If everybody wins, we can't be wrong. New York, the Best Director went to Sean Baker for The Florida Project.
This is very curious, but yeah, I think a lot of his directorial work in this one, they missed 5 out of the last 6 years, though.
It seems to be a tough topic to nail down, tough category. Critics' Choice nominations are going to be Guillermo del Toro for The Shape of Water, Greta Gerwig for Lady Bird, who's getting a lot of traction, Luca Guadagnino for Call Me By Your Name, Martin McDonagh for 3 Billboards, Christopher Nolan, who's big Gold Derby favorite for Dunkirk, Jordan Peele getting a nod for Get Out, and Steven Spielberg, Mr. Annual.
Yeah, another category that's somewhat chalk. Those are the heavy hitters. It'll be interesting to see that we don't have an obvious choice as of yet. I would have said a couple months ago that, you know, Christopher Nolan was going to be hard to beat. He's given, you know, catnip to the Academy with the, you know, the innovative nature of the movie. He obviously is technically putting a superior project out there. He's been flashy with the screenplays. He's getting great performances in a short amount of time from each of his, you know, main actors. He was probably the leader in the clubhouse for a long time. But yeah, I mean, Guillermo del Toro is getting a lot of publicity. And Call Me By Your Name is going to be tough to beat in its build up.
On Oscar night, if we have Spielberg versus Del Toro versus Greta Gerwig versus Christopher Nolan all sitting in a row there, that's going to be an interesting, very, very interesting.
We've talked about Get Out as well. I mean, where is Jordan Peele at his finest? As in the director's chair or with the screenwriting? You know, it's kind of hard mix.
That has to win awards. Decipher that has to win awards on Oscar nights.
Where that movie was
screenplay,
so brilliant.
Screenplay, directing, Kaluuya. Best Picture is where we're going to go next, and we're going to start by revealing the AFI Top 10 list. AFI annually releases the top 10 films of the year. Kind of offbeat hit, as it included Wonder Woman this year, which usually comic book movies, superhero movies do not get their
Wonder Woman, top 10 AFI.
The full list. The Big Sick, which was reviewed here by Mike and Oscar, Call Me By Your Name. Dunkirk, also reviewed in our first episode. The Florida Project. Get Out, also reviewed in our first episode. Lady Bird, The Post. The Shape of Water, 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. And the aforementioned Wonder Woman.
Notable snubs, I, Tonya, Mudbound, Darkest Hour, and The Disaster Artist. They've also been considered quite a bit.
Disaster Artist surprises me, not making the list.
Right. Feinberg Forecast has I, Tonya in place of Wonder Woman, and that is their top 10 in terms of Best Picture nominees. Two of the last 3 years, Oscars only nominated 8. So we're not necessarily guaranteed a top 10. Another interesting thing about Feinberg is that 2 years ago you had The Force Awakens involved. I wish we did the research. We didn't. Is The Last Jedi, was it eligible for AFI's top 10?
Good point.
I don't know. We'll probably have to follow up on that for you guys. But box office smash hits, Feinberg said that typically AFI goes towards the big studio releases more than the independent films, and Oscar goes more independent. But big box office smash hits like It, Thor Ragnarok, they didn't make it. Wonder Woman, the biggest.
No Netflix titles.
Right.
Top 10 either. No Mudbound.
Right. It's a little different. Now, I'm going to go through the last 3 years of AFI, just give you a quick stat on each in terms of their top 10, the AFI top 10, versus the Best Picture top 8 or top 10. Last year's 2016, they hit on 7 of the 10. There were 10 nominees for Best Picture at the Oscars. Another one of the AFI's top 10 was Zootopia, which won Best Animated Feature.
Sure.
So I guess you can say they hit on 8 of 10. The year before that, they hit on 7 of 8 Oscar noms. Again, the Best Animated Feature, Inside Out, was involved in the AFI top 10. Force Awakens and Straight Outta Compton were also in there. Again, saying, you know, Feinberg mentioned that it goes a little more studio heavy. Those are studio hits. Force Awakens was Star Wars reboot. I'm a little, you know, frazzled because I want The Last Jedi to be great. And The Force Awakens,
we'll find out this week,
was honored by AFI 2 years ago. This year, we didn't have The Last Jedi honored. Going back one more year, 2014, AFI's top 10 hit 6 of the 8 Oscar nominees for Best Picture. You know, they also had Interstellar, Into the Woods, Nightcrawler, and Unbroken as the other four out of the top ten. They missed Theory of Everything and the Grand Budapest Hotel. So, you know, it's you can take this coverage with a grain of salt. That's why we're kind of going through it a little quick. Interesting top ten by AFI.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how AFI is so accurate in the two film awards seem to be much more miss than hit in terms of predicting the what's going to happen on Oscar night. But for to finish off the category, the LA Film Critics Association Award Best Picture went to Call Me By Your Name, beating out The Florida Project. Interesting note that Shape of Water, which is getting so much love lately, didn't finish in the top two there.
Yeah, this show has picked the Best Picture winner the last 2 years, but they've missed 5 years before that. You know, so they hit, you know, Moonlight, they hit Spotlight, they hit with everything that said light in the title, but they missed 5 years before that.
Yeah. Playing a game of roulette. New York Film Critics Circle Awards Best Picture went to Lady Bird.
They've missed the last 5 years, so before you get too excited, and they're four for the last 20 years. I was able to do a big look at New York there.
Just roll the dice and see what happens.
I'm not surprised Lady Bird got picked there. That feels like a New York Film Critics movie, yeah.
Critics' Choice nominees, Best Picture, 10 nominees. Big Sick, Call Me By Your Name, Darkest Hour, Dunkirk, Florida Project, Get Out, Lady Bird, The Post, The Shape of Water, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. At least to me, most striking, Darkest Hour getting in there.
So Darkest Hour got in there. This is the same AFI list, except Darkest Hour for Wonder Woman. So we're kind of seeing, you know, contenders arise.
There seems to be a shape forming. As far as Best Picture goes.
We have I, Tonya, The Disaster Artist, and Mudbound left out of both the AFI Top 10, left out of the Critics' Choice Movie Awards for Best Picture nomination there. That is interesting to see. Is it just a matter of a later release date? These movies are not being seen early enough or as often as these others. I don't know. I'm rooting for like hell for I, Tonya, and The Disaster Artist. I'm not as so much rooting for The Darkest Hour or The Post. I mean, these seem kind of like annuals. We get movies like this all the time.
The Post, I'll disagree with you on, because Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep, I think, can't do wrong.
Yeah, I would have said that 2 years ago. Last year's Bridge of Spies was just a sleep fest for me, or 2 years ago.
The bottom line you take away from this is that in our first episode, I had The Big Sick as the best movie of the year, and it's making the top 10 list, so I'm a genius. But those are the primers, right?
Though that's Baby Driver, I saw.
Well, it was my number one rated movie, so let's not go there. Okay. Those are the primers, the biggest of the littlest award shows, I guess we'd say. Right. I mean, certainly award shows that carry merit and should be given deference and mean something. It definitely is starting to shape the Oscar picture as we just start getting on this starting line here. What we're going to do for you guys coming up is our next episode is going to be later this week. We're going to go over the Golden Globe nominations in detail, after which we're going to explain what our approach to Oscar season is going to be. We're going to have a lot of episodes. Like we teased last time, we had some stuff in the fire. We've kind of hashed out a plan and a plan of attack that we think is going to be make it easier for you guys and more enjoyable for you guys to consume the information. We're going to let you know specifically what you should be watching, what to look out for, and get you ready. I mean, we want Oscar night to be a big event for both the Mike and Oscar world, for the Mike and Oscar listeners, for us. We might have some other things, special things planned for you guys regarding that, but we'll get to that as it comes. Definitely stick with us. Like we said, if you have not started listening, or you know someone that's big into movies that hasn't started listening, there is no better time than now to catch up, go through all our year-end reviews, go through all our retrospectives, and get yourself ready, because this is going to be a big Oscars night, I think.
We're going to give you your fix. We're going to try to time some of these episode releases with the big movie releases out there. Again, we're watching these movies with you. We're talking about these movies, not months in advance ahead of you. We're talking about these movies as you're able to watch them, whether that's a release on VOD, Netflix, Amazon, or of course a release into your local theater. We're going to be talking about these Oscar movies as they hit, for the most part, as they hit video. We'll save some for the end, and we'll get you your reviews, we'll get you your Oscar movie fix, and get back at us, please.
Yeah, any questions, concerns, comments. As always, guys, we love hearing from you. I know we've been slacking on reading the comments, but we have been seeing them as you post them. So we'll try to give a couple shout-outs at the beginning of the next episode. Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Facebook. Mike, and Oscar on Instagram. MMO_pod on Twitter. We are Mike, and Oscar at Gmail. Those are the ways you can get in contact with us. We are up on SoundCloud and iTunes currently. I think we might be on Stitcher already. I don't know. I was looking into an issue with that before because someone said we might not. Share us, subscribe to us, leave us a review on iTunes, SoundCloud, wherever. Drop us a line in one of our social media pages. We love hearing from you guys, and we're doing this all for you. So we hope to keep doing it. We hope we're serving you some good.
Runners to your marks. That's right.
Get ready for the sprint. Guys, reality sucks. Keep on watching movies with us, especially as we get ready for the Oscars sprint. We'll check you guys out later. Thanks for listening.